ahead. Looking around the room today, I see that we've got some guests, participants from the states of Texas. I see some folks from Mississippi, Alabama, Florida. I hear there's someone here from New York. For all of you from outside of Louisiana, welcome. I think it's a tribute to the quality of speaker that we have here at this seminar that folks will come from such a great distance to come and listen, and we hope you all will come back in the future. In the spirit of outstanding speakers, our next speaker, Chuck Lipcon, is from Miami, Florida. There is within the practice of maritime law, for those of us who do personal injury, there's an area of cruise ship litigation that involves both cruise ship employees as well as cruise ship passengers, and it's truly a trap for the weary. Chuck is going to speak to us in a few minutes on the do's and don'ts and help us to figure out what to do when somebody calls with a cruise ship problem. Chuck has been a practicing attorney in Miami since 1971. He graduated from the University of Miami School of Law. You know, if in Louisiana we made a list of the top 10 maritime attorneys, certainly our two speakers after lunch, Bob Ates and Johnny DeGravels, would be on that list. If you presented such a theoretical list to lawyers in Miami, Chuck would be on everybody's list. He is an outstanding lawyer. He's a good speaker. And I'd like you all to please welcome Chuck.
Thank you. Can you all hear me?
I have this mic turned on. Okay, great. Well, first of all, I realize that the only thing standing between you and lunch is me. So I'm going to try to be pretty quick. I want to thank the Louisiana Trial Lawyers Association and Scott Silbert for inviting me here. I'm always happy to come to New Orleans, go to Emeralds, and have some good food. I'm very impressed with what's going on here today. I was here for the first two speakers, and I can see this is an excellent program. Admiralty and maritime law has many traditions. It's rich in history, goes back to the time of the Phoenicians. There's some great stories. And in that vein, and as soon as I get through this, I'll get to my topic, I got this wonderful email from G.J. Sullivan out of Jacksonville. And I'm just going to read it to you verbatim. "Gentlemen, I don't know if this story is true, but for a maritime lawyer, it's just too good not to pass along. Manure. In the 16th and 17th centuries, everything had to be transported by ship, and it was also before commercial fertilizer's invention, so large shipments of manure were common. It was shipped dry because in dry form it weighed a lot less than when wet. But once water at sea hit it, it not only became heavier, but the process of fermentation began, again, of which a byproduct is methane gas. As the stuff was stored below decks in bundles, you can see what could and did happen. Methane began to build up below decks, and the first time someone came below at night with a lantern, boom. Several ships were destroyed in this manner before it was determined just what was happening. After that, the bundles of manure were always stamped with the term ship high in transit on them, which meant for the sailors to stow it high enough off the lower decks so that any water that came into the hold would not touch this volatile cargo and start the production of methane. Thus evolved the term SHIT, ship high in transport, which has come down through the centuries and is in use to this very day." So, G.J. Sullivan, that was too good to pass up. Have any of you been following the George Smith case? This is the missing groom and the bride were on their honeymoon. They're on the Brilliance of the Seas. They've disappeared, or the husband disappeared, and there's blood all over the cabin down below. Have you all been seeing that on TV? Well, my topic will cover that. So it just seems it sort of has come together perfectly. For over 30 years, I have been handling cruise ship cases. And the cruise line industry basically started in Miami, which is where I was practicing law. So as it got bigger, I did better. And that's why today, because I'm probably the oldest maritime lawyer in Miami, I now show up on these lists that Scott talks about, only because I've been around that long. I'm going to give you some do's and don'ts, because with 18 million people taking cruises every year from all over the United States as well as all over the world, there's a really good chance that you're going to be talking to somebody who became hurt, sick, injured, killed, disappeared on board a cruise vessel. It's just going to happen. And the cruise lines have adopted the strategy after 9/11 of using more different varied ports so people don't have to fly to get on their ships. I believe you have some coming out of Louisiana now, New Orleans, some going to Texas. It's just happening all over the country. So you will, if you have not already spoken to a passenger on a cruise ship, you will be speaking to them. If you only remember one thing from what I tell you, remember this, because this is going to keep you out of malpractice trouble. Every month I hear between 2 and 5 stories of lawyers missing the statute of limitations. And the reason is the cruise lines are allowed to put in their ticket, if they do it properly, and believe me, they all do it properly, they are allowed to limit the time in which they're sued to 1 year. Also, there's a 6-month notice clause. That 6-month clause can be satisfied usually by passenger going to the doctor, say, I got hurt, I had an accident, filling out an accident report. But to be on the safe side, you want to notify the company within 6 months, and you don't want a year to go by. Because here's what happens to the non-maritime lawyers who aren't familiar with this practice. They start negotiating with the cruise line. You know, they figure, you know, why not try to settle the case? And the cruise lines will sucker them along. And once the 1 year passes, that lawyer gets a letter, and the letter goes something like this. Well, gee, now that we've had time to review the whole matter, we realize we have no liability, therefore no offers being made. See you later. And that's when the attorney says, well, now it's time to file suit, and it's too late. It's too late. And I often thought, well, gee, you know, I could probably have a whole subdivision of just suing lawyers for malpractice from the number of calls I get every month. It's pretty sad. So that's the one thing you need to remember. 1 year. Read that ticket. Someone comes in, the first thing you want to do, read the ticket the cruise line gives them. It's a lot of stuff in there, but that 1 year sticks. The second thing that sticks is that the cruise line is allowed to select where they can be sued. They have a forum selection clause. And most major cruise lines are based in South Florida, so they have selected Miami. Now, in my entire career, I have hated forum selection clauses. This is the only one that I happen to agree with philosophically as being a brilliant idea. It's like a huge funnel, bringing in cases worldwide to our office so that half my day is spent with people who just had a new problem. Yes? The trigger date is 1 year from the date of the accident. I personally will sue, if I have the opportunity, will sue based on the date the voyage starts. But it's really from the date of the accident. That's a good question. Whenever you deal with the cruise lines, my number one rule is be paranoid. They are so good at figuring out loopholes and how to get away with stuff and how to do things in the most tricky way possible, that you just cannot be too careful. So that's my number one rule. Be paranoid. So on that venue clause, some people, many people, make the mistake of suing in their local court system. It's no good. They'll be kicked out 99 times out of 100. If you sued in federal court, the federal judge will usually transfer it to Miami, and you're okay on the statute. If you sued in your state court, you had it. You're toast. Because filing in state court does not toll the 1-year statute for bringing suit in the correct court. That's another good basis for malpractice that I hear about all the time. Now, you can read about all these cases. I personally put out the Cruise Line Law Reporter. I decided about 5 years ago, we were doing so much of it, I would try to make it into a subspecialty. So I started the Cruise Line Law Reporter. It's free. It comes on the internet. You go to www.lipcon.com, say, I'd like to get this for free, or just check the box, and you will get it. And the nice thing about the Cruise Line Law Reporter is I figured as long as I was doing it, that all maritime decisions really affect cruise line decisions, because they are vessels, after all. That basically it's a summary of all brand new cases that just came out, you know, that are reported, district court and appellate court. So it's a great way for me to stay up to date on these things. And you'll see a good number of those cases deal with lawyers suing in the wrong location. Now, my first practical tip to you, I guess it's the second one, is if you want to win your case, what you should do is only take cases that win. Now, what do I mean by that? This has taken me 30 years to figure out. I have spent a lot of time on cases that just evaporated. They went nowhere. I put a lot of time, money, and effort into it and had a client who thought I was just a screw-up. So I have learned the hard way, and I paid my dues to find out that when that case comes in, don't be so anxious to take it that you don't do your job. I interview the client like I'm the defense lawyer. I go after everything I can think of that will mess up the case. Then I want to find out about witnesses. I'll talk to those witnesses before I take the case. I'll even get their doctor on the phone and pay him $200 or $300 or $400 in a conference call with the potential client and speak to the doctor to make sure, hey, did this accident really cause that injury? And when I have all my ducks in a row, then I take that case. And it's really worked out very well for me. So if you take cases that have a good chance of winning, have good damages, you won't be wasting your time, you won't be wasting your client's time, and everybody's going to be happy in the end. Now, on the ticket, there are exceptions to that one-year clause, but they're very rare. If someone's on a group tour and they don't get a ticket, that's an exception. If it's a minor, there's an exception with minors. The statute gives minors 3 years to sue, but there's a triggering device. If the minor appoints a guardian, then you're back to the year. So you need to look at that very carefully if you're dealing with a minor. If the ship does not touch a U.S. port, and many people will catch the ship in Spain, like the Brilliance of the Seas, where George Smith disappeared. I believe they started in Spain, and he disappeared between Greece and Turkey. That contract very well may pick a foreign forum. It could be in Italy, it could be in Spain, it could be in London. Those are enforceable at the discretion of the judge. The judges can tell you, yeah, we're going to disregard that, or no, we're going to enforce it. My experience is that judges enforce those clauses. I don't understand why, except it gets rid of a case and speeds up their docket, I guess. But I have not been very successful in getting judges to disregard foreign forum selection clauses. The other thing, if the vessel does not touch the U.S., then you're dealing with the Athens Convention, which limits your damages to 44,000 drawing rights. Don't ask me what that means in dollars, because it changes every minute. It's based on a basket of currency. It could be anywhere between $50,000 and, let's say, $70,000. So you could have a case. This is why you got to look at your ticket. You could have a case walk in the door, and it could be a terrific case, could be worth $1 million, but if that person got on the cruise in a foreign country with a ticket that says sue in Genoa, Italy, and you're subject to the Athens Convention, you could put a lot of time, effort, and money into a case that's going to be limited to 44,000 drawing rights. So that's another thing to look at in that ticket. Now, there have been several areas over the years that I've tried to devote my attention to. First one is shipboard medical care. In a word, it's awful. People get on these ships and they think they're going to get the same kind of medical care they can get in the U.S. They do not get it. I have seen cases where people without medical licenses do surgeries. I've seen cases where the doctor is not licensed anywhere in the world. He took a correspondence course from the Dominican Republic and got his medical degree, and the cruise lines hire him to treat people. It's absolutely a hornet's nest. And historically, the cruise lines have not been liable for bad medical care until recently. It took me about 20 years to get the Carlisle decision. And it's just a horrendous medical care for a young girl who suffered a burst appendix, became sterile. This went to the appellate court in Florida, Carlisle versus Carnival Cruise Lines. And the appellate court agreed that the nature of shipping has changed. 200 years ago, they'd give the doctor a cabin on the ship, you know, and he would get a free ride over to Europe, and in return for that, he'd treat some of the people, and then he was gone. But now the doctors are hired full-time. They may work 3 months, 6 months, 9 months, but they're full-time employees. They wear a uniform. They're considered an officer. There are pictures on the wall with the captain and the staff captain. So in the Carlisle case, the appellate court has said that the cruise lines are liable for the bad medical care of their doctors. And that has been an enormous decision, because the bad medical care is going on all the time. The doctors know they're virtually untouchable. If that doctor is not living in Florida, and usually he's not, he's from England or South Africa or studied in somewhere in Africa, you can't even find him to sue him. So it leaves a lot of people without anybody to sue. So this has been a real breakthrough case. Unfortunately, the cruise lines, being as smart and as clever as they are, hired a former judge from the appellate court to do the rehearing. The argument that was made was, gee, if you're going to pass these kind of decisions out that hurt the cruise lines, and we bring so much money into Florida, we just may take our ships and go somewhere else. That's the basis of their motion for rehearing, and they got a really good dissent out of that. So the Florida Supreme Court has taken that case for review on certiorari. I'll be arguing it on September 27th. And this is a case that affects thousands and thousands of passengers who are getting really crappy medical care. There is a way around that, though. I mean, even under the old rules, the shipping company had to hire qualified doctors, supposedly. And they had to, since they have a shipboard medical facility, I would always sue them for not properly equipping the facility, for not having proper procedures, things like that. But that's a much harder road to hoe. Another area that's booming right now on cruise lines are sexual assaults. It's actually open season on the high seas. The crew members all know, and the cruise lines all know, that if a crew member assaults a passenger or another crew member, nothing bad happens to them. The worst thing that happens is maybe they're fired. Sometimes they're transferred to another ship, but maybe they're fired. And the cruise lines, about 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, they came out with Carnival that they had 100 sexual assaults in a certain period of time. And there was this old brouhaha. And the International Council of Cruise Lines came up with a zero tolerance policy. That means the crew member wasn't supposed to get one free rape. The zero tolerance policy was supposed to be strictly enforced, and they would shut all of that down. Well, that just hasn't happened. It has not happened. The cruise lines, they hired an independent consulting firm to research the problem, and after three or four court orders, I got the Sexual Awareness Task Force report. And this document is kind of shocking because it tells the cruise lines that the crew members have learned that there are no consequences to them sexually assaulting passengers, except maybe they're fired. Now you combine that, they're foreign flag vessels, they're working the crew members 7 days a week, 16 to 18 hours a day. They don't get to visit those houses on shore that the judge talked about earlier. So they're on this ship, it's a powder keg of sexual desire. The stuff that goes on these ships down below is beyond belief. There's multiple gang rapes, use of roofies or other drugs to tranquilize the passengers. There's sexual extortion that goes on. It's an absolute epidemic on these ships. It's also a very good source of cases. If people are willing to come forward, and occasionally they do, they're excellent cases. The cruise line is strictly liable if a crew member sexually assaults a passenger. The cruise lines is aware of that, and as a consequence, when those type of crimes occur on board a ship, and there's plenty of crimes, but when those sexual assaults occur on board a ship, who handles it? Is it shoreside security, the chief security officer? No. It's handled by the risk management department, the people who are in charge of the purse of the company. They immediately go into a defensive mode. They send a lawyer to the very next port. And I can tell by which lawyer they sent what kind of thing they're defending against. If they send a certain lawyer, I know it's a sexual assault. If they send another one, I know it's something else. But they immediately get on top of that, and the risk management department totally controls the investigation. This is very important to bring out, because I think when a jury sees, you know, what's really going on, they'll understand why the evidence has disappeared. They'll understand in the George Smith case why at 7 a.m. the next morning that all the blood that was on the awning was being washed away before the authorities ever got to the boat. They'll understand why at 2 a.m. in the morning, between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m., that the room has been steam cleaned and vacuumed four times. They'll understand why the pictures or the evidence of the crime are awful. They're Polaroid pictures taken from a distance of 4 inches that are out of focus, even though they have professional photographers on board. The jury will understand that there's a cover-up going on and that the evidence is being destroyed, tainted, and twisted against the victim. The victim is usually victimized the second time. Now, fortunately or unfortunately, these cases do settle very quickly. They never seem to see the light of day. They settle, confidentiality clauses, you can't reveal the settlement, and then they're gone. But because of this George Smith case, there's been a lot of media attention in the last 2 or 3 weeks, and the FBI has actually gone back a second time to try and solve the crime. In a case that we handled against Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines, we learned of 173 sexual assaults against passengers in a 3.5 year period. And out of 173 sexual assaults, the cruise line had a perfect record, zero prosecutions. The FBI did not prosecute one case, even though they had jurisdiction over these crimes. And I asked the FBI fellow, I said, hey, why don't you prosecute these cases? And their answer was, it's a low priority. And also, they're getting bad evidence. By the time they get there, the evidence is gone or has not been handled properly. So this is a huge problem with the cruise lines. And it should be something that if it comes into your office, you need to take immediate steps to put the cruise line on notice, saying, we want copies of all the videotapes of our client. Because if those videotapes hurt the cruise lines, they just seem to disappear. So put them on notice so you can have a spoliation case. Do that right away. Try to go on board the vessel. Do that right away. Get an investigator on board the vessel. Even if you got to send them on a cruise, put them on there before you let the cruise lines know what you're doing, because everything's going to disappear. They have total control over all the witnesses. If a crew member knows something that hurts the cruise lines, they go home on vacation, even if they've just been there for a week or two. And that vacation becomes permanent. And try to find a witness like that out of 2,000 crew members. It's not easy. I have mailed out letters to every person on a crew list. And then if they're working on another ship, you don't hear back for a year or two. So that's a huge problem. You need to find out who your witnesses are. Normally what they'll just do is say they know nothing, even if they were the ones cleaning up the blood. They'll try to say they weren't there. So that is a huge hurdle to overcome. The next area of where you have a lot of accidents are shore excursions. The cruise lines make a lot of money from selling shore excursions. They might sell you a shore excursion for $50, but only one-third of that is going to the people who actually provide the shore excursion. These shore excursions, they use, you know, rickety buses. Safety is not really thought about. And in that ticket, going back to the ticket that we talked about earlier, the cruise lines put in there that they are not responsible for independent contractors, including the shore excursion operators. So they have insulated themselves very well from the shore excursion people. And you can't sue, well, up to now, it's been difficult to sue the people operating the shore excursions because they're only in foreign countries. Well, one day after, I don't know, 25 years of thinking about it, I decided to file a Rule B attachment and garnishment. And this is a beautiful way around the shore excursion problem. So you have a situation where the cruise lines is not liable. The shore excursion people are not in the United States. So what do you do under Rule B? You can sue all of the cruise lines they do business with. And if they do business with one, they're probably doing business with all of them. And what you do is you attach the money that the cruise lines owes to the shore excursion operator. And that becomes your defendant. And I'm doing that right now with Holland America Lines. That's the first case that I've handled this way. And they are just howling like stuck pigs. It's just so sweet to actually say, hey, you're in Costa Rica, but I'm putting my hands on your money now. And every month I serve Royal Caribbean Cruise Lines with another garnishment and tie up another $30,000 to $50,000. And there you go. This is how you get to the shore excursion people. Now, that's not over yet. I don't know how it's going to turn out, but I think it will turn out very well. Getting the cruise line's attention. Those of you who think you can settle with them, make no mistake about it. You won't be able to unless you're willing to recommend to your client to take a $100 off coupon for drinks on their next cruise. Or if you have a really, really good case, maybe they'll give you 20% off the entire cruise price. That's the best you're going to do. They don't settle cases. I've been suing them for 30 years, and I try to settle a case with them. Nothing. You have to sue them to really get their attention. If you don't sue them, it's hardly even worth talking to them. Once you sue them, depending on the cruise lines, some will settle, some won't settle. But the starting point is the lawsuit. So I usually don't even try to settle. I just sue them and then try to settle. Royal Caribbean, you have a chance. Carnival, sometimes. Norwegian Cruise Lines, never. Silver Seas, never. Oceania, yes, you can settle with them. But you have to get their attention. And also you have to pay your dues. The first 10 years of this work, I didn't settle one case. I tried every single case against the cruise lines. I remember during the two-month period, I had six trials at one time, and I had two going simultaneously. I was waiting for a jury in one, and across the hall, the judge grabbed me and said, "You're starting." I said, "I haven't finished." And the other one, he said, "No, you're starting. You can pick a jury." I said, "I don't know the file." He said, "Pick the jury. Read your file tonight." The second case that I tried in the closing argument, I argued the closing from the first case. I won that case, and their point on appeal was I referred to the wrong plaintiff and wrong defendant in the closing, and therefore it should be reversed. And that's when I knew I had pushed the envelope, and now I have people to actually help me. So, but yeah, to get their attention, you got to sue them, and you got to be willing to go to trial. Now, in my 30-some years being the oldest maritime lawyer in Miami, I've learned a few things. I'm just going to pass those on to you. First of all, after you've taken the winning case, read The Art of War. It's a little book. It will take you an hour to read it. It's written by a general in China, a general who unified China. And I am certain the cruise lines have read this book. You need to read this book. The Art of War is very interesting. If you're strong, make your enemies think you're weak. If you're weak, make your enemies think you're strong. Above all else, use spies. And I like that use the spies part, because I found that, and I've tried a lot of cases, I found I don't like to tell the other side what I'm going to be doing to their witnesses. I don't take a lot of depositions. But what I do is I do a lot of research. So if Dr. So-and-so is coming in, there's a nice depot bank, depot connect. You go in there, you get past transcripts from the doctor. And the other lawyer doesn't know you have those depositions. Get articles the doctor's written. I mean, with the internet and the web and all of that, it's become so much easier. You get so much more information by researching the person than you do by taking their deposition, usually. Now, this is, you know, a matter of style, but that's my style. And to give you an example how it worked out once for me, I had a case, an orthopedic case, a back injury, and the other side got one of their usual, you know, defense doctors to do the exam. I researched him out and found out that that doctor, he was an orthopedic surgeon, was on disability. And what was his disability for? He couldn't see well enough to do surgery. He was having visual problems. He couldn't discern the little things that had to be discerned during surgery. And our whole case boiled down to what did an MRI mean? And those MRIs, if you look at them, they're really tiny. So during that trial, after this doctor, you know, pretends to read the MRI that he can't see, I pull out a transcript from his trial where he sued for his disability coverage. And I just said, "Doctor, aren't you on disability? Isn't your disability based on the fact you don't see well enough to do surgery?" And when that came out, it was like I had punched the other lawyer in the stomach. It was a great feeling. He was totally surprised. So that's why I say, well, it's not using spies, but it's using the internet and using the resources that are available. Another thing that I like to follow is I don't take advice from my opponents. Lawyers love to be chatty with their opponents, and I think that's fine. I think professionalism requires that we all have a good relationship. And I think it's nice that we talk, and I think it's nice that we go to lunch and do things like that. But I don't think it's a good idea to let your opponent advise you on how you should handle your case. And I find it shocking that so many lawyers do that. They listen to their opponents and start to repeat what they've heard from them and sort of take up their cause. I have that in my office, and I see it, where young lawyers will repeat what the opponent has told them as though it's gospel. It's not gospel. And what I like to do, I like to turn that around. When I'm coming up for trial, remembering the art of war, I tell my opponent, I say, gee, you know, I think the biggest issue in this case is X. I'll just say, you know, just in a conversation, maybe at a hearing or something, and then I'll leave. And when we come up for trial, that lawyer is so ready for X, he doesn't know what to do when Y comes in. It's just like playing a good game of chess. You're just faking to the left, but going to the right. So read The Art of War. That's all I can tell you. I think good settlements come from good preparation. If the other side knows that you're willing to go to trial, if they know you're eager to go to trial, if they know you want to go to trial, you will get the settlement that your client deserves. But that you have to really mean it, you have to really prepare it, and you have to really act that way. So many lawyers prepare their cases for settlement, but they don't prepare them for trial. And the other side knows that. I mean, you know when you have a case and it's coming up and the defendant really didn't do his job and then he realizes it's going to trial. He'll spend the last 10 days doing 4 depositions a day trying to get ready. He knows he's not ready. You know he's not ready, but you should be ready. And that's when you get good settlements. In trial, be totally honest. I see young lawyers, you know, they have a problem with their case, and they try to manipulate the information. That never works. People see right through that. So if you've got a problem in your case, be the first one to tell the jury. Just say, gee, you know, Mrs. Jones, you know, she tripped and fell over this threshold that you have sticking up in the middle of the floor. She's got bad vision. You know, do you think the cruise lines has any lesser duty to her than to someone with good vision? Do you understand that the cruise lines know that half the passengers they have on the ship are on Social Security and are elderly and they can't see and don't walk well? Bring it all out before the other side has the chance to do that. You steal their thunder away. And then you find out if you've got a jury that's going to go your way also. Be precise with your words. Words are very important. We make our living from words. And I think they need to be extremely precise. I think our use of words should be, we should be shooting bullseyes if we were archers. Hit the bullseye each time. A couple of thousand years ago, there was a fellow named Confucius who had a good saying, and the saying was, when words lose their meaning, people lose their freedom. And I think today, we have a lot of people taking words, twisting them around, and they're losing their meaning. And the cruise lines are expert at this. They get right into a case and they take statements, and they twist them for the people. They write it up for them. And then people are not tuned into how important that statement is, and then they sign it, not realizing that later on they're going to be looking at a giant blow up in court. So words are really important. And once they're down on paper, I find that juries think they are 100% correct because they're written before a lawyer got involved. But that's not totally true because the cruise lines lawyer is involved from the get-go. From the moment that accident happens, there's a whole procedure that's set up by the cruise line lawyers. You need to bring out that procedure and let the jury see what's really going on there with those words. Now, I have, starting at page 3 of the outline, what I've tried to do is just give you a little bit of the law on the different areas that can come up in a cruise line situation. Now, I'm not going to read through this. You can all do that if you have a case and you need to. You can just scan through it or get on Lexis or Westlaw. But one last area that I want to discuss with you are class actions. I have found every time that I turn over a rock that deals with the cruise lines, that's hiding some type of secret, some type of manipulation, some type of maneuver they have done to benefit themselves financially. So in the last year and a half, I probably have filed between $1 and $2 billion in class actions. So when that client comes into your office, talk to them in great detail. Find out exactly what happened. Find out where they were lied to. Find out where the distortions occurred. And see if you can come up with a class action. I think that's the only thing that will get them to improve their conduct. The cruise lines, all the major cruise lines, have been convicted of polluting the oceans from which they make their living. They have been found guilty of creating false evidence and false documents, false logbooks. They have admitted guilt to obstruction of justice by lying to the authorities, such as the Coast Guard. So this is who you're dealing with. You're dealing with companies that earn all of their money in the United States but pay no income tax. You're dealing with companies that pick up U.S. passengers, but because they fly foreign flags of convenience, are able to work their employees 7 days a week, 16 or 18 hours a day, and pay them pennies on the hour. You're dealing with cruise lines right now that have figured out, in order to make an extra nickel, that they have tapped into the tip money of their employees. Have any of you been on a cruise? By show of hands, who's been on a cruise here? Okay, a lot of you have been on a cruise, and probably on those cruises you tipped your waiter, you tipped your cabin steward. That's all changing right now. What the cruise lines are doing is they're saying, and this is a very fertile area, they're saying, we're going to save you all that trouble. You won't have to give them cash. We're going to charge it to your room for you, a fixed amount each day. Well, guess what, folks? That fixed amount is being charged to the passengers, but the crew members aren't getting it. They're getting half of it. Immediately overnight, their wages were reduced by 50%, and they don't know what to do. They don't have a clue what's going on. Class action. Everything they do has class action implications. They do it on a fleet-wide basis. So if you're able to figure out something along those lines, then I think maybe their conduct will improve. Yes, sir? You don't have a question? Oh, okay.
Is the foreign selection clause valid? Let's say somebody from Iowa purchases a ticket through their travel agent up there in Iowa, but purchases a ticket to catch the vessel in New Orleans, and the voyage starts in New Orleans. That foreign selection clause says Miami, Florida State Court. Is that foreign selection clause
Okay, I'm going to repeat back your question because I was instructed to do that for the tape. The question is, if someone in Iowa purchases a ticket to catch a vessel out of New Orleans and that ticket says suit has to be brought in Miami, yes, that is valid. It's the SHUTE decision versus Carnival Cruise Lines. And as I said, that is the only well-thought-out forum selection clause that I've ever seen. Back here, yes, sir.
Chuck, I've got a question speaking of cruise lines. I have a case in Toronto Cruise right now, and one of the issues in our case is a suspicion that they altered what actually ship logs.
Are they altered the logs?
They altered the logs.
What a surprise. Yes.
In fact, altering the laws, making misrepresentations. And they had to be convicted of a felony against that corporation. Do you have any advice about trying to utilize that conviction in the typical way you would if you were dealing with an individual and attacking the credibility of the company?
I want to thank you for bringing me an easy question right up front. The question is can you use the prior conviction of Carnival Cruise Lines where they altered a log in a case where you suspect they have altered a log in a subsequent case? Is it an injury case? Okay, I have researched that, and the research that I found is that you can use it only if the same people are involved. You cannot use it against the corporation because the corporation did not do it. I have a game plan for that, which I have not had a chance to implement. My game plan is to, on cross-examination, when the representative is on the stand, to ask them, isn't it your policy to alter the logbooks so that it helps your company when you go to court? And they'll say, no, that's not our policy. Well, then my next question would be, well, has your company ever altered logbooks to make them look better in legal proceedings? And at that point, if they say no, then I would try to impeach him. I haven't gotten that far. If they say yes, then maybe that's the end of it. But I can't imagine them admitting to doing something like that. I mean, just knowing how they think. They'll say anything, and then later on, you know, if you catch them, they'll say, oh, I didn't know. You know, we have 50,000 employees. How would I know, kind of thing. Yes, sir?
I've got two questions. In collision cases where limitations of liability is an issue, sometimes lawyers will sue the captain, sue the master, as well as the company and the vessel. In the passenger theft cases that you see,
I've never done that, nor have I had a case involving a cruise line where they asked for limitation. I mean, the value of the vessels today is $500 million. I guess if there was a sinking, you know, we would see that, but fortunately, there have not been any sinkings major sinkings in the last 30 or 40 years. I think the Angela Lauro caught fire off of Africa. I don't know what happened with that, but I was not involved.
My question is really the notion of suing the captain as well as suing the cruise line and suing, I guess, the Foreign Selection Clause, say you have to go to state court?
No, the right now the Foreign Selection Clauses for Carnival and Norwegian Cruise Lines specify you have to go to federal court. And that issue, I believe, is on appeal. There have been several judges who have ruled that it's invalid because you lose your right to a jury trial if you're from Florida and you sue in Florida. So that's up in the air. We're waiting for an appellate decision on that. I would say this, though. I would, you know, if the Forum Selection Clause selects federal court and you want to be in state court, and file in both courts. You know, just file a protective action in federal court. I've done that, and I just put in the federal court action. You know, oh, by the way, I have filed this case in state court. I'm filing it in federal court to protect the statute in case that becomes a problem. You know, I just let the judge know right up front in the complaint. There's plenty of law that says you can bring a case in both courts simultaneously. So right now, that's how we're handling that situation. As far as suing the captain goes, we've been kicking that around, and we have these cases involving the POEA and Philippine Seamen. I know you have that decision out of the Fifth Circuit that says that the arbitration clause is valid and the Philippine Seamen have to go back to the Philippines, which I don't quite understand, but the Eleventh Circuit adopted the same position, and in cases I was working on dealing with the Norway explosion and Philippine Seamen, a petition had been filed to the U.S. Supreme Court, at which point the cruise lines went to the Philippines, ignored the fact that the clients had lawyers, went directly to them, and settled for a lot more money than they could get in the Philippines. So there are no more clients left to go to the Supreme Court. That's the other thing. They do not mind going behind your back and settling a case out from under you. And then you have to sue them for that, and it's long and tedious, and but sometimes it has to be done. Any other questions? Yes, sir?
I just want to say that I just completed a trial, a simple statement, that everything that you said your trial rate kept, you know, going up significantly in trial, you know, the way they should have been at the end. In 5 days, was probably all but a good settlement, but something that, you know, Louisiana and Mississippi lawyers anticipate they overseas, you know, in a pre-trial conference. We didn't get that amount of money pending until, I mean, the case was just about annihilated. They knew that half the case, pretty much, you know. So I know what you've done is correct. What you told us is correct. I experienced it. I filed before Judge Donald Bryant and U.S. District Court in the Southern District just a couple of weeks ago.
Well, thank you for that comment. You're obviously one of the most intelligent people in the room. And I'd like to buy you lunch right after I'm done. But it's true. Anybody who is litigated with the cruise lines, we have Robert Gross from Miami who's back here. He can tell you, he can reinforce the same thing. And the comments that I have made, they don't come lightly. I mean, I can back them all up with all kinds of stuff. Yes, sir?
I didn't follow you a while ago when you said that the requirement to sue in federal court is new to right to jury trial.
Yes, sir. What happens is the Carnival and Norwegian Cruise Lines, in their ticket, requires that suit be filed in Miami in the U.S. District Court. If the person is from Florida, they do not have diversity because their principal place of business for both of these defendants is in Florida. So you don't have a diversity situation. Those people will lose their right to a diversity jury trial. Now, one thing that I've done is when I file an admiralty, let's say I have to file an admiralty, you know, you file a 9H claim or whatever it might be, I always ask for a jury trial anyway because 3/4 of the defense lawyers are very young and they don't know you're not entitled to it. And if they don't bring it up, the judge doesn't bring it up. So I've had jury trials in admiralty, and nobody's ever gotten into, oh, this is advisory only and it's not binding. It just isn't raised. So, art of war. Do whatever you want until they stop you. Yes, sir? When you say that it happened off the ship, is it a short excursion?
It's a short excursion.
Okay, that gets back to what I was saying earlier. Okay.
But it's not a sponsored tour.
Okay.
But it is an activity. It's an exciting activity. It's a port call that was choosing a cruise line to bring them there. And one of the things that, and I know there are the cases that talk about responsibility for what they knew or should have known on board at the port of call is the case of Rosetta and Alaska out of Bahamas.
Yeah, the duty to warn. They have a duty to warn of dangers that are known or should be known.
But what I would like to do in trying to present this case to a jury is to point to all the advertisements, all the cruise line advertisements, to talk about all these exciting things, but where they're really selling packages. The passengers have no choice about, you know, where they're going. They haven't researched really the locale. They're in essence trusting themselves, you know, for hotel and food and their safety and customs and everything else to the cruise line. So they're not investigating the areas. So what I'd like to do is try to use some evidence like the television advertising to try to make that point with the jury. Have you or anybody else
I've never really tried to do that other than in the shore excursion where they're selling the shore excursions themselves situation. But I don't know why you couldn't do it. You could also plead some type of misrepresentation claim and make that a central theme of your case and try to do it that way. I think it was a lady over here with it. Yes, ma'am. No, There's no magic language. You just have to put them on notice, you know, who the passenger is, when the event occurred, little information about it. And the courts have held that the passenger going to the doctor and saying, oh, you know, I slipped by the pool and broke my leg, that's adequate notice. So there's no magic there. Anybody else? Everybody ready for lunch? Thank you very much.